bookstore and registration and so on. And we're very happy to be doing this. This is, in fact, the third teach-in where we have worked with IFG, International Forum on Globalization, and others. The first one back in 2001 was entitled Technology and Globalization, A Marriage Made in Heaven or Hell. A very prescient subtitle, I must say. And then about 6 years or so ago, right here in this very space in Cooper Union, we were very happy to work with IFG again on a big teach-in on indigenous peoples and the indigenous resistance to corporate globalization. They've both been outstanding events, and I don't have a shred of doubt that this is going to be another one too. It's such a crucial issue, and an issue that flies under the radar with our generalized acceptance of and absorption in and elevation of all things technological to being a valuable and indisputable future for humanity. This is a contrary voice asking the right questions. And there's nobody better to serve at the center of that conversation, to sound that dissident voice, to pose the necessary questions, than Jerry Mander, who has really been at the heart of this work for a long time, dating all the way back to his book. There he is. There he is. Jerry's really the heart and soul of these events. I mean, just the way he pours himself into creating these phenomenal teach-ins with the unique style that bring people in literally from all over the world. It's a truly unique and brilliant contribution. So many of you know Jerry already, so I'll just say a few words of introduction. But he is the author of many books, starting with Four Arguments for the Elimination of Television back in the 1970s, a first real take on techno-utopianism. And he's In the Absence of the Sacred, on the Failure of Technology and the Survival of the Indian Nations. There have been quite a number of other books since. Most recently, it's The Capitalism Papers, on the critique of capitalism as a system that's in its declining phase. Paradigm Wars, co-sponsored, The Case Against the Global Economy and for the Local Economy, and others. We have them all out. They're all out in the bookstore table, so I encourage you to take a look at them. So Jerry has been a brilliant critic of rampant globalization and of our unthinking embrace of technology. He's a founder and was for many years executive director of the International Forum on Globalization, where he now serves as a distinguished fellow, and he's project director for the Techno-Utopianism and Globalization Project of the Foundation for Deep Ecology. So he's going to go on first before we go on to our panel. This is a non-stop day, but you can those of you who are not New Yorkers can certainly find plenty of refreshments if you can drag yourself away from the hall in the very immediate surroundings, not far here from Cooper Union, which I should say, by the way, is a truly historic spot. This is where Abraham Lincoln clinched his nomination. So it's a place that exudes history, and it's a very appropriate place to be doing an event like this, which I think is of a historic clarity and a great bringing together of a lot of the clear-sighted minds. So it's my great pleasure, I should say, to really welcome the man at the heart of this event, who's done so much with his team to pull this together. He's really one of the most courageous and clear-sighted and penetrating thinkers and writers that we have on this great subject of technology and globalization. So let's give a warm welcome to Jerry Mander.
Thank you so much, Ralph, for that embarrassing introduction. It's great to be here, and I appreciate so much the help we received from the New York Open Center as well as our other partners in this project. Thank you. New York Open Center was absolutely magnificent from the beginning to the end on this project, and we really appreciate it very much. Also, our co-partners, International Center for Technology Assessment, that's Andy Kimbrell's organization, has been magnificent. And the Schumacher Center for New Economics has been very involved as well, and we appreciate it. And there's also a list of 20 other organizations who have signed on to this project and have helped in various ways, and you'll see those in your program. So welcome. Thanks so much for coming to this teach-in. Maybe we should really call it a marathon rather than a teach-in. There's going to be 50 speakers over 22 hours on 2 days in a steady stream, covering as many nuances and aspects of this question as we could manage to fit. And very few breaks, you might have noticed, in the schedule. However, there is a nice coffee bar in the lobby whenever you need it or want to talk things over with your friends or with any of us who are around. I do believe this meeting is extremely urgent, given the state of the climate and of the skies, the state of the oceans, which are rapidly acidifying, corals disappearing, sea life disappearing, and now the news of the imminent sixth great extinction, the expected loss of 30 to 50% of all wildlife species on Earth by mid-century. This is not to mention disappearing fresh water, disappearing fertile lands, forests, food supply, and much more we will be reporting. This is definitely one of the gravest moments in history right now, and we're here to explore the role of technology in making this happen and our attitudes and acquiescences that have contributed to it. Producing this event has actually not been easy. We live in a techno-dazzled world, and there's considerable resistance to the very idea of challenging technology. In fact, as we were planning this event, I got a call from a very well-known reporter at the New York Times, a very friendly, supportive guy who has written beautifully about our anti-globalization events in the past. He said he found the event very exciting, but he also said the program seemed too biased against technology. Weren't we going to invite the other side? I had to tell him, no, we weren't. I mean, as we proceed, some of us may express appreciation for some obvious benefits. I mean, I wrote about this conference on a very old, decrepit, 10-year-old laptop. It still gets the job done. That's good. But before that, I wrote some books with an Underwood manual typewriter, including some of my better ones, I might add. It was slow, but slow was good. Ideas pop up instead of ads and email blips and texts. And let's see, I flew here on an airplane, I took a taxi from the airport, and I'm talking into a microphone. There are lights in the room. Even I use some technology, okay? How could I not? But that is not the point. The point is to get clear on the systemic totality of impacts from all of it before it's too late. The pluses and the minuses. Besides flying me to New York, what else have airplanes brought us? Besides taxis from the airport, what else have automobiles brought? Pavement covering the world. Massive nonstop oil development, resource depletion, not to mention climate change. And now we have computers. They tie the world together. They accelerate communication. They make corporate globalization more likely and more effective. And they accelerate its negative impacts. They also separate us from ourselves and reduce real communications to tweets. Another writer calls it digital nowhere. And Sherry Turkle, of whom I'm a great fan and try to get her to come, calls it alone together. But we'll get more into that as we go. I argued with my friend from the Times. I pointed out the fact that nearly all information we get from about technology comes from the people who invent, promote, and sell it. We don't really need to hear from them at this event. We hear from them every day on TV and on the internet. We've been hearing from them for years. U.S. corporations now spend about $200 billion a year in advertising, telling us what to think about things and to say what's great about their products and services. I doubt many people in this room spent even a billion to counter these messages or much more than the $50 it probably cost you to get in here. Monsanto Corporation, for example, doesn't really need to be here to respond to our panel a little bit later on genetics, later today, to tell us what's so great about GMOs. Over the last 3 years, Monsanto has already spent $402 million arguing that GMOs are wonderful. Dow Chemical and Union Carbide spent similar amounts. General Electric doesn't really need to tell us about clean, safe nuclear energy. We've heard that. And we don't need Eric Schmidt to tell us about computers, driverless cars, and Google Glass. We get it. We want to discuss the rest of the story. What else do they bring? How do they unify our minds within a certain worldview? How do they envelop us within their frameworks? What are their hidden harms to the planet? And how do we deal with the staggering information imbalance that exists right now in our country on these questions? So, okay, let's get started. I'm already running out of time, I see. We have 50 speakers this weekend, and we're each of us allowed only 15 to 20 minutes. You're going to hear gongs go off when we proceed after 15 minutes. And I've already used at least five. Where to begin? Should we start with agriculture 5,000 years ago? How about monotheism? Or with the Enlightenment 300 years ago? Maybe we should. They're all relevant. But I think I'm going to start in 1936, the year of my birth. In the midst of the Great Depression, and just as World War II was getting underway. Hopefully, it will lead us to a list of good questions we should have asked about technology before this global mess ever got underway. In 1936, there was still practically no commercial plane travel of the sort I just took. Jet airplanes were non-existent. There were no space satellites, no microwave ovens, no faxes or copying machines, no tape recorders. There were no stereo music systems in 1936. There was no television. There was no plastic in 1936. No plastic. There was no air conditioning, nor were there freeways, shopping malls. There were no suburbs, as we came to know them after Levittown was constructed. There was no telephone touch dialing, no birth control pills, no Viagra. There were no credit cards. There were no pesticides or herbicides, no computers, no tweeting or texting, no nuclear weapons in space. That was 78 years ago. During my lifetime, all that has changed. 4 years later, in 1940, my family took me to the great New York World's Fair. More than any prior event, the New York World's Fair set out to create a techno-utopian, highly romantic vision that set the dominant expectations of the post-World War II, 1940s and 1950s. More than 45 million people visited the New York World's Fair during its two-year tenure. That was over one-third of the country's population. It was a fabulous event. I remember it vividly. More than any prior event, it emblazoned in the public mind a new set of expectations for technology rising up over the horizon. The possibility that there could be negative effects on the planet or on human society and welfare from any of the above was never, ever mentioned. And we didn't know to ask. The exhibits were produced by the biggest corporations of the day. I saw seven-tier techno cities, monorails transporting people at 300 miles per hour, drone-like things whirling between 500-story buildings, humans flying with little rocket packs on their backs, while robots at street level walked the dogs. Ronald Reagan was speaking out as the voice of General Electric, and the DuPont exhibit offered their slogan, "Better things for better living through chemistry." The cities of 20 years hence, that would have been 1960, had eliminated all slums, were filled with parks featuring controlled climate, always a good day. Controlled climate. There were happy Americans living in domed environments on other planets. Another exhibit showed how with modern air conditioning, we'd soon be living underground. Another exhibit predicted the conquering of all disease, the extension of our lifespan to hundreds of years, the elimination of insects by pesticides, and the total end of poverty. 45 million people experienced what was essentially an advertisement for a future techno paradise that we would all love. Wouldn't everyone want a fully automated household and voice-activated shopping? Doesn't everyone love cute little robots? New technology would bring happiness, prosperity, peace, the American dream, never before so passionately sold. As a child of those times, I found the images thrilling. They became a mental blueprint that I carried into the future in common with most of my generation. That the vision was merely a corporate representation of the future never occurred to people. That there might be downside problems for some of these visions was never explored. That it could have deleterious effects on nature never mentioned. It was a one-sided story meant to promote corporate profits and ferocious economic growth. Where was the other side? Another key moment came as World War II was ending. The U.S. economy had saved itself from the Great Depression by massive wartime buildup, military production, and employment. But with the war nearly over, and the troops coming home, and the factories still building tanks and jeeps and bombs, what next? In the 1950s came a new focus on consumer products, much of it rooted in war-related technical advances. Cheaper, faster air travel, chemicals, pharmaceuticals, and pesticides for home use, washing machines, refrigerators, hi-fis, fancy cars, as well as radars and sonars. And two other dramatic new technologies suddenly appeared. One was computers, though still at that point for military and industrial use for the most part. But maybe most important of all, television. TV had actually been invented decades before, but suddenly had a higher purpose. TV could merge with advertising to lead the transformation of American society into a consumerist society. Television became the greatest delivery system for advertising ever invented, and it still is. Between 1945 and 2013, U.S. corporations spent $500 trillion in advertising, by far most of it in television, all celebrating the same worldview via different products. Over the last 50 years, including right now, the average American watched television for 4.5 hours per day. Those are the statistics for right now, too. That means half the population watches more than that. Computer use has not replaced television watching. It has massively added to our screen time, a problem in itself, disembodiment, alone together. The average person receives about 30,000 commercials per year. So technology-driven consumer society was born, featuring mass production, nonstop economic growth, planned obsolescence, and techno-utopianism. We began to equate technological evolution with evolution itself. The homilies became technology brings progress, progress is good, there's no turning back. The environment still had no visible place in the story, at least not until the 1960s. When Rachel Carson wrote her great book about pesticides, and David Brower came along to rock the boat with the Sierra Club. But the downside of the story rarely got out very far. The opposition movements didn't have the money to tell the opposition story. There was still no legal process of formal disclosure of dangers of these lifestyles, no fairness doctrine, except very briefly, no assumption of guilty until proven innocent, no precautionary principle, no downside information at all, except for the occasional nuclear catastrophe. Mostly we stayed on the national joyride. You get to go to Walmart or Home Depot and say yes or no. That's the democratic process as far as technology is concerned. Meanwhile, the process goes on. Corporations are proceeding to convert military drones to corporate and consumer drones. Later today, we'll learn more of the big battles against the redesign of molecular structures of the planet, nanotechnology. We will hear more about geoengineering emerging to so-called block climate change, creating new skies to offset climate change. Wouldn't we rather keep the older, bluer skies? I would. And then there's the genetic reinvention of humans and other species, the invention of small nuclear bombs as well. That's all before we get to the total envelopment and immersion of our lives by digital and cyber tech. Is this what we want? Did anyone ever ask us? Can we please have a vote on this? I'm going to say before I close, I think I need to say a bit more about the role of advertising, if I have enough time. It's a subject we don't usually discuss at events like this, but I think we should. I'll be quick about it. I am a former advertising executive. So let me tell you that advertising imagery, which we all tend to think of as dumb and stupid, is very powerful and persuasive, especially in that kind of volume that I've mentioned. We don't think about it much, but advertising is a process of projecting very powerful imagery over and over directly into your brain. Most people scoff at the notion that such images have power. We like to think our intelligence protects us, but advertising has nothing to do with intelligence. It is simpler than that. It is image implantation. Look, if I say Energizer Bunny, or Taco Bell Chihuahua, or how about Geico Gecko, did a picture of those little animals appear in your head? Did you know you were carrying them around? Can you unsee those images? My late partner in the advertising business, Howard Gossage, once said, there's a dirty little secret about advertising that nobody understands, that once the images are in your head, they never go away. They are yours forever. The image lives in your head and in your brain and really becomes you, especially if you don't make efforts to actively study what's being said and figure out what you think about it. If it's coming at you at the rate of $200 billion per year, well, it explains a lot. The information imbalance in our society is vast and tragic. 200 billions a year, by the way, the average viewer sees 30,000 commercials every year. How can we protect ourselves from this? So, in conclusion, I'll read you a short summary list. 8 recommended attitudes about technology that I propose we should agitate for, get them codified, maybe discuss as we go over the weekend. 1, the precautionary principle. Since nearly all of what we're told about technology comes from its proponents, be deeply skeptical of all claims. What's been left out of the story? We can no longer assume that new technology is innocent until proven guilty. The opposite should be the case. Guilty until proven innocent. That's the precautionary principle. It must be codified. 2, never judge a technology by the way it benefits you personally. Always seek a holistic view of its impacts on nature, on resources, on people, on the future. The operative question is not whether it benefits you, but who benefits most and to what ends. 3, get rid of the idea that all technology is neutral, that it can be used for good or bad. Every technology has inherent identifiable social, political, cultural, and environmental consequences. Langdon Winner calls it autonomous technology. If society accepts automobiles, you get the roads covering the land, the oil development, and so on. There's no way around that. The idea that technology is neutral is itself not neutral. It ignores intrinsic dangers and puts blame solely on users. 4, make distinction between technologies. Is that 18 minutes? Okay, I got 2 minutes. Make distinction between technologies that primarily serve the small community, let's say local solar and small-scale farming, and those that inherently operate on a large scale, like nuclear or fossil fuels. 6, do not accept the homily that once the genie is out of the bottle, you can't put it back. All it takes is public discussion. All it takes is public discussion and empowerment. Let's start that today. 7, in thinking about technology, always emphasize the negative, as I'm doing, because that's what's usually left out of discussion. This brings balance. Negativity is positive. Finally, my last point, we need to ask some direct questions about the continued viability of any economic system that has an obvious intrinsic need to drive the kind of destructive behavior we're here to discuss. The use of technology to drive constant growth on a finite planet motivated by self-interest and profit and amorality in the face of obvious devastation. Such a system may have been viable at a much earlier time on this planet when resources and nature were abundant, but it's now clearly obsolete. It is time to start experiencing and outlining the ingredients of something new and relevant that starts with and is bound by respect for nature, its limits, and its wildlife, as well as people. We will hopefully have a good discussion about this over the weekend, and I've got to stop there, so thanks so much for your attention. I want to introduce Richard Heinberg now. He's a magnificent, brilliant guy that I've known for a very long time and constantly impressed with. His steadiness, his genius on these matters. He is a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute and is the author of numerous books. The one that's my favorite is called The Party's Over. That's one of the first ones. Power Down, Peak Everything, The End of Growth. They're all very, very good on the question of growth and the overuse of resources and what we need to do to change it. And I forgot the name of his new book. What was it again, Richard?
Snake Oil.
Snake Oil. His new one is coming out shortly called Snake Oil. So let's welcome Richard Heinberg. Thank you.
Well, as Jerry did, I'm going to start by talking about a formative experience in my life, and that was reading this book, Limits to Growth, which was published in 1972. I was 21 years old at the time, and it changed my life. I realized for the first time in my young life that society was on an unsustainable path. And so I've spent the last 42 years or so figuring out why that is, how we got into this situation, and where we're going from here. Basically, the Limits to Growth study, carried out by some MIT scientists, was an effort to use computers to model the likely interactions between population growth, resource depletion, and environmental impacts. And the standard run scenario showed a peak and decline in world industrial output sometime in the early 21st century. Of course, mainstream economists thought this was a horrible thing that they would come to such a conclusion, so there must be something wrong with the study. And these days, if you hear about limits to growth, you'll typically hear about that it was debunked long ago, which is definitely not the case. Recent retrospective analysis has shown that the most pessimistic of the scenarios in the study, the standard run scenario, is tracking actual real-time data quite closely. So what I want to do over the next 16 minutes, hopefully, is explain to you how I think this is coming together in real time, how we're experiencing the limits to growth, and I'm going to talk about it in terms of energy, debt, and climate. Starting with energy, because energy is the most important thing in the world. Without energy, nothing happens. And energy is at the core of economic growth. Basically, before the fossil fuel revolution, we used energy primarily from food crops and firewood, and we exerted energy into our environment to get what we wanted and needed by way of muscle power. All that changed when we discovered how to use coal, oil, and natural gas and how to extract them in large amounts. Think about it this way. Maybe you've run out of gas in your car and had to push your car 10 feet off to the side of the road. That's hard work, right? Car is a big, heavy thing. Imagine pushing your car 20 or 30 miles. How much work would that be? Well, depending on how big you are and how big your car is, let's say a couple of months of hard work. Well, we get that done for us, our car getting pushed 20 or 30 miles by a single gallon of gasoline for which we're paying $3 and change. So 2 months hard human labor for less than $4, that's incredibly cheap energy. And it's dense and portable energy. It's really, really useful. It's the equivalent of magic compared to what we were able to do before. We've effectively discovered buried treasure, a huge trove of buried treasure, and we've gone on a spending spree over the course of the last few decades. This is what the oil industry looked like back in the 1930s. This is what it looks like today. So technology has been applied to the process of energy production. And on the other side of the coin, having all of this dense, portable energy cheaply available to us has been a spur to technological development. We found more and more ways of using that energy, very often to replace human labor. You know, it costs so much more to hire a person to use muscle power in so many instances than it does to use a fossil-fueled machine to do the same thing. But of course, fossil fuels have a couple of problems, one of which, of course, is that burning them changes the climate. We'll talk about that in a moment. The other problem is that they are non-renewable, finite resources. So as we extract them, we are in the process of running out. Now, of course, we're not about to literally run out of oil, coal, or natural gas anytime soon. But nevertheless, we've extracted them using the low-hanging fruit principle, the best first principle, so that the easiest, cheapest, highest quality fuels are extracted first, and then we go from there. So this problem of depleting resource quality or declining resource quality is impacting oil first and foremost, and oil just happens to be the most important of the fossil fuels from an economic standpoint, because virtually all of our transportation depends upon oil, and transportation in turn is at the heart of trade. So the global economy essentially runs on oil, and over the last 10 years, something has happened in the petroleum world. Effectively, cheap oil has gone away, and the rate of extraction of regular conventional oil has flatlined. We have seen some increases in oil production recently, but it's all been in the unconventional category. That's tar sands up in Canada, or light tight oil in the Bakken Formation in North Dakota produced by fracking, or ultra-deep water oil from the Gulf of Mexico, and so on. We've hit a point of declining returns on investments in production of oil, exploration and production of oil. As I said, the oil world is fundamentally changing, and the price of oil is another symptom of that, because whereas 10 or a dozen years ago, all of the responsible agencies like the International Energy Agency were predicting that today we'd have oil priced around $25 to $30 a barrel. Instead, it's been up around $100 a barrel until just the last 3 months or so, when it's taken a nosedive for reasons that unfortunately I can't explain in 16 minutes. but temporarily declining prices don't solve the underlying problem, because the underlying problem is that the industry actually needs even higher prices above $100 a barrel to go out and look for and produce more of the tar sands, ultra-heavy oil from Venezuela, ultra-deep water oil, and so on. But society can't pay more. That's really why the price is dropping. Demand is decreasing because the economy is weakening. So people, unfortunately, don't understand these underlying dynamics. Instead, we hear the advertising messages, largely, about the wonders of hydrofracturing, light tight oil, shale gas. Now we have 100 years of cheap gas, we're told by the industry. We at Post Carbon Institute wanted to track down the real story here, so we've hired out the data on over 80,000 currently producing shale gas and tight oil wells, and looked at the location of each well, the initial production rates, the evolution of production over time. What's the real geology here? And what we found is that this is basically a bubble. It's a very short-term flash in the pan. We know this because individual wells decline so fast, typically 70% in the first year. So the industry has to drill and drill and drill thousands of wells each year in order to keep production from crashing. And that's what they've been doing. It's been heroic rates of drilling that have created the shale gas and tight oil boom. But there are only so many places to drill. And our analysis suggests this is the peak will happen within probably the next couple of years for both shale gas and tight oil. It's all downhill from there. And this is what the tar sands look like. The problem is, as we move to lower grade resources and have to apply more sophisticated technology, not only does the price go up, but the environmental impacts and risks increase exponentially. This is a great way of visualizing the whole situation, the resource pyramid. We've been extracting conventional resources up at the top of the pyramid, and you'll hear that, you know, there's immense amounts of coal, oil, and natural gas still underground, and that's absolutely true. As I said earlier, we're not about to run out. But we get to certain, we start at the top of the pyramid and drill our way down, and as we do so, we get to certain limits. We're at the price technology limit right now, where yeah, we know there's a lot more oil out there, but the price isn't high enough to pay for the technology that would be needed to get the rest of that oil. And then just below that price technology limit, which is where we are with petroleum today, is the energy in equals energy out limit, where it would actually take a barrel of oil's worth of energy to go out and find and produce that next incremental barrel of oil. So at that point, oil may still be a useful lubricant or chemical feedstock, but it ceases to be an economic source of energy. And you'll note that most of the resource is below that energy in, energy out limit. So yes, again, plenty of resources there, but it's almost irrelevant. Important principle, energy return on energy invested. One of the magic features of fossil fuels was that in the early days, it only took a trivial amount of energy to drill an oil well or pull coal out of the ground or natural gas compared to the amount of energy that we got through that process. That energy return ratio is declining. This is very seldom talked about, very little understood, generally speaking, certainly by economists, but it's at the heart of economic growth. This is the economy back in 1970. This is the economy that we're going to be facing in, say, 2030. Much higher energy inputs to yield at the lower end of the diagram you see, you know, consumption, staples, and discretionary. That's what the economy is all about, right? And in 1970, it didn't take much to produce a big payoff. That payoff is going to decline. Okay, debt, second category. We're talking about energy, technology, and money here. Money seems to make the world go round, but it's all based on energy. Early in the 20th century, our biggest problem from an economic standpoint was overproduction. With all of this cheap energy and some new technologies like the powered assembly line, it was possible to make stuff in much greater quantities than people were accustomed to buying it. So solutions, advertising, as Jerry was talking about, whole new industry. And, of course, as time went on, advertising messages became much more sophisticated. The purpose, of course, was to persuade people to want stuff that they didn't realize they wanted. But that wasn't enough because at that time, in the early 20th century, most people bought stuff with cash. And new technological products like the automobile, too expensive for most people to pay cash for, so we needed something else, consumer credit. We needed it to be possible for people to consume now and pay later. So over the course of the 20th century, consumer credit grows and grows and grows. We reach a turning point in the 1980s. With globalization, a couple of important technological innovations, computer monitoring of inventories, satellite communications, and container ships make it possible for workers on the other side of the planet now to compete with workers in American factories. So U.S. hourly wages go flatlined. But by this point, we've become addicted to growth. We've created a consumer society. Consumerism is not just a perverse predilection of individual Americans. It's a system by this time. It's a system that is ingrained in our banking system, even our monetary system. So how do we keep that growth-based, consumerist system growing? Well, at this point, we've got to increase debt, because we can't do it just with increasing wages for consumption. Consumer spending by this time is 70% of the economy. We have to keep people spending more, but they're not making more money. So how do we do it with more debt? And so starting in the 1970s and 80s, debt begins growing at a much higher rate than the economy as a whole. We can do this with debt-based currency, and we've been doing it famously. And I'm not talking about government debt here. I'm talking about consumer debt, corporate debt, debt within the financial industry, as well as government debt. And this is basically what's happening. As you can see, in 2008, we seem to have hit the limits to debt, at least in this country, and really most countries around the world. And since then, debt in most categories has not been growing so much. So government has stepped in as the borrower and lender of last resort, the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury and Congress and all. And now everyone perceives this as being a huge problem. But actually, it goes much deeper than that. yeah, money is something that is a human invention. It's we can create it out of nothing. But nevertheless, there are rules and norms within the system of finance and money, and those are fraying, are coming apart. We've reached some inherent limits. They're not as important, though, as the limits we're reaching with regard to the environmental impacts of burning fossil fuels. And here you already, I'm sure, know the story. I don't need to tell it to you. As we burn coal, oil, and natural gas, carbon dioxide is released into the atmosphere. The result is global warming. Why does this impact economic growth? Well, if we were to really do something about climate change, what would be entailed is dramatically and rapidly reducing our combustion of fossil fuels. But our economy runs on fossil fuels. So if we had decades and decades to do this, maybe, conceivably, we could do it without impacting the economy that much. But we've got to do it really fast. And the replacements for fossil fuels, you know, they're really good. I'm a big advocate of solar and wind. We need lots more of them. But they're not going to drive the kind of economic growth that we saw during the early 20th century. So, in a way, it doesn't matter what we do about climate change. If we don't do anything about it, then the costs of climate change to the economy will increase and increase to the point where they make further economic growth no longer possible, as seas rise and coastal cities are inundated, as crops fail, and so on. Or if we choose to stop climate change in its tracks by dramatically reducing fossil fuel consumption, in that case as well, economic growth is basically over. So we have this sort of pincer effect from several different directions. All of these trends are telling us one thing, that the party is over. And in some ways, that's a good thing, because the party hasn't been equally distributed, for one thing. It's been extremely unequal in terms of the world's population. Just a tiny proportion of world's people have benefited enormously, while lots of other people have seen their lives negatively impacted by all of this. And then, of course, the rest of the natural world, loss of, we just learned, half the world's animals over the course of the last 40 years as a result of economic growth, production, consumption, and so on. So we're on this train that's speeding up and speeding up, and the only thing we care about is that it's going faster this year than it was last year. That's the only measure of success in our world, economic growth. And meanwhile, we face a world of limits. So I'm not going to try and wrap this all up in a nice, neat, happy package for you. We have the rest of the weekend to talk about this conundrum. All I've hoped to do in this short talk is frame the situation. And so we have a lot to think about and talk about in the next few hours. I'm glad to be here with you to do that. Thank you.
Now I'm going to introduce Anuradha Mittal, great friend. I met her first when she was working at Food First. It was as executive director of Food First in Berkeley, but she's since then taken on the leadership of the Oakland Institute and has done astounding work in mainly the third world countries about land theft by American investment companies, depriving indigenous peoples of their lands in order to speculate on the lands or develop them for resources or mines. And it's just going on to such a degree that very few of us were aware of the degree to this is happening until Anuradha came along. She's exposed a tremendous amount of this activity worldwide, and including investments by Harvard University and American colleges in some of the worst, most dangerous land developments that have deprived indigenous peoples of their rights and lands and caused enormous pollution and environmental problems all over the third world. And Anuradha is also on the board of the International Forum on Globalization and is the author of the book, The Great Land Grab, and here she is, Anuradha Mittal.
Good morning, everyone. Well, of my whatever time I have, I want to take a brief 30 seconds to further embarrass Jerry. I just want to talk about what will happen today and tomorrow. You know, every time I try to have a conversation around synthetic biology to geoengineering, I'm told it's scientific. Looking at me as if, like, you don't get it. It's scientific. Most of us have been told these are issues that are best left to the scientists, best left to the regulatory agencies, because they know what they're doing. So we can go ahead and continue our shopping or whatever we need to do. The next 2 days remind me of what I have personally gone through when IFG has organized teach-ins, whether it was around World Trade Organization in Seattle in 99, or when I just learned about this whole global economy teach-ins in 94, actually in New York. My first arrest actually in the United States happened because I went to that teach-in. Because that information that you get and that spillover that happens, that we need to take back the democratic spaces, that's what these teachings have done for many, many of us. So I want all of us to just turn around and give a big hand to Jerry and the team that has been putting these together. Technology, I don't know how to use. Oh, it does work sometimes. I'm here to talk about stealing nature, but also about stealing life. Our history has been pockmarked where these top-down development solutions, these silver bullet solutions that have always been sent around to the world, especially the global south, which are based on technology, this technocratic approach to development. People sitting in Washington, D.C., in Geneva, in Brussels, they know better. In 2008, there was a food price crisis where the food prices increased by over 83% between 2007-2008. And suddenly, there was a renewed focus and interest in agriculture. At the same time, there was a financial crisis. Pension fund, investors, they were suddenly looking for the next soft commodity to invest in. The result of the crisis, these two crises, food crisis, financial crisis, has been corporations let loose on the developing world. This is a quest for virgin lands, for virgin forests, looking for minerals underground, creating a land rush that no developing country has escaped. So seeking this next soft commodity to invest in has resulted in land and water grabs, whether it is in Africa, which is worst affected, or Asia, Latin America, the Pacific Islands. The whole thing is couched in a language of sustainability. It'll create jobs. It'll bring technological innovation to this dark continent. It'll create jobs. It'll help elevate lives, end poverty. And at the same time, talking about advertising, there's a drumming of this fear. How will we feed this growing population? We need to go and invest in agriculture through corporations the way it is happening. How will we meet this insatiable appetite of China and India? We need red schemes. We need carbon credit offset schemes so we can continue to consume the way we do in the north. And the answer lies in these lands far away in Africa and Latin America, Asia. The whole idea of this advertising is that technological innovation, industrial plantations, will remake Africa. They will help feed not just Africa, but help feed the world. They will save the world. The key pillar of this land and life grab is technology and infrastructure, genetically engineered seeds. Farmers, 80% of the food consumed in the developing world comes from smallholder farmers. But in this approach, this top-down approach, these smallholder farmers, if they're not in the export economy, they're useless, they're not successful. They have to be replaced and turned into plantation workers in these large plantations. As Jerry mentioned at the Oakland Institute, we have been looking at the impact of these land deals around the world. We have done very detailed country reports, Ethiopia, Mozambique, South Sudan, United States, Papua New Guinea. Having looked at hundreds and hundreds of land deals, I can share some basic findings. One is, if this is such an amazing solution, there's no transparency around it. You know, you think you can go to Lusaka and Zambia and you can get the listing of all the land deals, the lands that have been taken away. Not possible. You go to Mozambique, you go to Ethiopia, there's no information. You have to get to the ground where you meet communities who woke up to find bulldozers, you know, destroying their homes, destroying their fields. Free prior informed consent, none of that. These people, these villagers who have no postal addresses, do not have a title deed which says it is their land. You don't need to consult with them. Why are they all headed to places like Africa? It's the price of land. You find the most fertile lands for which you would pay $14,000 to $17,000 per hectare in the US, or $26,000 or $28,000 in UK. People are getting 99-year leases for which they pay as low as 40 cents per hectare. Hectare is the size of a football field. So there were deals that I saw by a US former ambassador of refugee affairs. In South Sudan, he managed to get 1 million hectares of land for $25,000. With the right to cut down teak and precious wood that was on that land, he could grow whatever he wanted, from corn to agrofields. They could even do under the ground digging for minerals, for oil, and had the right to sublease it. They talk about benefits to communities. Over and over again, we found what it results in: people displaced, people who grew food for their families, for their communities, turned into plantation workers. Or as one investor told me in Tanzania, who got the largest land deal, when I asked him, "You have such a great deal, what did you have to promise?" And his response was, "The government is very sensible. They know that we won't be hiring the local people. We will hire South Africans." Kept quiet for a second, looked at me again, and then he said, "White South Africans?" Who are these investors? Who's driving it? We were stunned. Usually we hear, "Oh, it's the Chinese investors." We found investors from everywhere. Jerry mentioned Harvard University, Vanderbilt, to pension funds. How many of you have money in TIAA-CREF, TIAA-CREF? That's one of the biggest, largest land grabbers in this world, which is heavily investing in land for speculative purposes. Land is seen as the next gold, in fact, better than gold, because it's not just the prices are increasing, but you can rent it out and do other things to it. So let me share a few examples of it. Let's see. This is Heraklis, since we're in New York. I talked about the language of sustainability. Heracles Farms went to Cameroon, managed to get a 99-year lease on 73,000 hectares of land. It is committed to sustainability. What it doesn't tell its investors, these 73,000 hectares are in the world's second largest rainforest. The plan is to cut down the rainforest to put in place a palm forest. The next one, just Sockfin, again talking about advertising. This is Bolloré Group from France, one of the Fortune 500 companies in Sierra Leone. The idea is, again, through belonging to RSPO, to take over communities' lands, and they've been fighting back, and instead put in a palm oil plantation. In fact, the people who protested, it's been 5 years now, have been facing a lawsuit for defamation and for fighting for their resources and their land from Sockfin. Some of them are more honest. This is Mvest, a company from England which invested in Mozambique and Zambia and Swaziland, and they were more honest. They're breaking new land. Their ideology is that you need to invest in land because we have to feed China, and the second area you should invest in is arms because we will go to war with China. And these are the strategic relationships. This is a slide from an investor called AgriSoul from Iowa. Belongs to Bruce Rastetter, the Republican kingmaker who owned the third largest ethanol plant. But this says it all. The idea for taking over the largest land deal in Tanzania was they can bring Syngenta and Pioneer and the banks together to revolutionize what agriculture will look like in Tanzania. But let me just share what really happens. This is through mapping that we did, the impact of Heracles Farms in Cameroon. After cutting down, they were hoping to cut down 73,000 hectares of this forest in Cameroon and put in the palm oil plantations. By exposing them and revealing what their real intent was, today that land deal has been reduced to a temporary lease of 3 years. And from 73,000 hectares to 19,000 hectares. It's still 19,000 hectares too much. And the communities are still organizing to get this company out of their lands and their forests. This is Sockfin, the promise of sustainability in Sierra Leone. When I visited them first, this area first, there were homes. There were small fields that belonged to the farmers who lived on the land who were forcefully evicted, and you have this barren soil there. This is Ethiopia. Ethiopia, which desires to become Africa's lion. This is going to be the Renaissance state, which using technology is building the largest dam in Africa. It plans to displace 1.5 million indigenous people, whether it's the Suris or the Mursis or Surmas or the Nyungathams or the Anuaks. And as we speak, in Gambela, killings are happening so people can be evicted. So the Karaturis of this world, so Ruchi Soya, or the other cotton and sugar plantations can happen on their lands. This happens while United States, England continue to finance and provide funding for Ethiopia for development, because this is what development and renaissance looks like. It might sound like after saying this is going to be an important 2 days, these are pretty depressing news when we look at the number of people being displaced, when we see our forests being destroyed, when we see people who depend on minor forest produce and the wildlife and biodiversity that remains on those land, the threat it faces. But what keeps us going, whether it has been Papua New Guinea or whether it is Ethiopia or whether it is Zambia, one thing that we've been told over and over again, this is our land. This is where we were born and this is where we will die. No government, no corporation can kick us out. No technological solution can feed us the way we have fed ourselves. So resistance is happening. It's leading to conflict, sometimes violent conflicts, which cannot be condoned. But let me give you a few examples. This is in Papua New Guinea, where people mobilized. And nobody would have thought a nation which has given away over 11 million hectares of land to logging companies, or given away land to so-called palm oil developers under special agriculture business leases. The president of Papua New Guinea this year had to come out and cancel illegal deals this year, which has taken back 5 million hectares of land. It is possible. This is in Argentina. This is a plantation owned by Harvard University, which is destroying the lands, the livelihoods, and the environment of the local people. Imagine a community in a small village in Argentina rising up to Harvard University. Is that happening? Yes, it is. We just don't hear about it. This one is one of the most beautiful stories that I would like to share. I mentioned the largest land deal in Tanzania. Bruce Rastetter, AgriSoul Summit Farms. They managed to get this land deal, the largest in the country, while nobody knew about it in Tanzania. 800,000 acres. They wanted the government to change the regulations so they could grow GMO corn. They wanted the government to take a World Bank loan so a railway line could be put between their farms and to the port. They wanted this area, which was classified as a special watershed under Ramsar Convention, they wanted it to be classified differently so they could pour in as many pesticides and herbicides as they wanted. More important, they forgot to mention that actually people lived on that land. They said nobody lives on that land. These 800,000 acres were over three different plots. And just in one area, in Katumba, over 160,000 smallholders lived. These are people who came as refugees over 40 years ago. They were told by the government that we'll give you citizenship, finally, after 40 years, when most of them, actually half the population, was born in Tanzania, spoke Swahili, knew nothing about Burundi or DRC or Somalia. They were told, we'll give you citizenship papers if you break down your own home and the churches that you have built. If you bring it all down, we'll give you $100 and a citizenship papers and tell you where to go. This is the Dracula once was brought out into the sunlight. It had no place to hide. It had no place to run. Just last week, the people living on that land, 160,000 people, got the citizenship papers, and there is no need to move. They will stay on their lands. They will farm the land, and they will take care of the biodiversity, and they will take care of that watershed area, and they will have, and they have in fact sent a strong message to the government that large lands schemes that you bring in as your development will not happen. To end, I would just say, so what can we do about it? Because communities are rising and fighting back. How can we, who so depend on these communities, the food that's grown in the rest of the world, how can we support them and join the struggle? At the Institute, we got a little tired of going, you know, case by case, AgriSoul and others, till you look at who are the drivers of this. And guess who it is? One of the biggest ones is the World Bank. Remember that institution? The World Bank. World Bank actually does doing business rankings. It ranks countries on what they like to do business with. So if you as Sri Lanka say that, you know, following the war crimes that we did towards the Tamil, we still have all that land and we're going to, instead of returning it to the Tamils, we'll give it to corporations, you get a good ranking. You as Liberia say, hey, as a foreign investor, you want to come in, we are not going to ask you to do environmental impact assessment, you get an even better ranking. And then you as Sierra Leone say, get what? I just got rid of minimum wage requirements. These rankings are not based on the well-being of the nation, the communities, environment. They're based on how low you're willing to go, creating a race to the bottom. So at the Institute, we have launched a campaign that we are pleased to report is now supported by over 260 organizations around the world, including trade unions, farmer groups, community groups, people impacted. It's called Our Land, Our Business, not the World Bank's doing business. In fact, this institution never held polls in our countries to ask for the right to be able to do a report card on the nations. Who gave it the right to do any kind of ranking? It just usurped that right. So the campaign's hashtag, if you're onto Twitter, I know tweeting won't save the world, is hashtag world versus bank. This is really about a democratic space. This is about our biodiversity. This is about our food systems. The world has always known how to feed, how to clothe, how to provide jobs with dignity. The problem is how to remove those in power who prevent that from happening. Yeah. We live in the belly of the beast. And very often, we are told all this is legal. You know, there are regulations around GMOs. It is legal for a food to be contaminated. It is legal for the poor, the pastoralists, the indigenous, to be expelled from their lands. You know, speaking at a teaching organized by IFG in Hawaii, as I was speaking and sharing that it's all legal, I realized, and I said, you know, segregation was legal. Women didn't have a right to vote. That was legal. And I was shocked at myself because I said, fuck legal. And I have actually learned we need to say that, fuck legal.
Hi there. That was great, Honorata. Thank you. I just want to mention, just on a logistics point, we started a little bit late on this panel. We won't have time for audience questions, but we'll be hanging around in the cafe today, so feel free to come up to any of us at any time and talk more. Right now, I want to introduce Andy Kimbrell, whom I've known forever, and he's been involved in this technology, these technology issues, at least as long as I have, except that he's younger than me, so maybe not as long. But he notably started the Jacques Ellul Society some years ago, which was the first kind of formal effort to create a formal institution devoted to the questions that we're talking about today. It was an extremely interesting series of mostly private meetings, but he was also co-organizer of numerous teach-ins on technology starting at least 10 or 15 years ago together with the Foundation for Deep Ecology and so on. Andy is probably the country's leading activist, or at least one of the leading activists on anti-GMO campaigning, and as a result is the target of many spurious lies from Monsanto and other corporations, but he takes it in great cheer. He's also the founder of the International Center for Technology Assessment, which is the co-sponsor of this organization, as well as the Center for Food Safety. And he's a great writer and a great thinker and a great pianist also. We tried to get him to perform this time with Richard Heinberg, who's a great violinist, who I think will perform tomorrow at some time when we get a break in the action. Maybe Andy can practice between now and tomorrow, and they can perform together. So here's Andy Kimbrell. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Jerry. It's been great working with you on this program. I made numerous suggestions over many weeks and months, none of which really have been taken. But the fact that you have breaks, and the fact that we start at 10 every morning is due to me. So he said, no breaks, we start at 9. That is the one real influence I think I've had on this program. I want to thank the Open Center as well. They've been doing such great work for so long, and I'm so grateful to them over all these years. And, of course, the Foundation for Deep Ecology, which speaks to all of our hearts in its great work. And also all the people that make this possible. Is Claire Greensfelder here? She does such an amazing job on all of this, and I just want to thank her personally as well. Thank you, Claire. So I'm supposed to describe the rise and inevitable fall of market capitalism in 20 minutes. Well, somebody has to do it, so I'll take a shot at it. Actually, market capitalism was born out of technology. It was really, if you think of the medieval ages, you think of the mercantile age, really all production was done in the village and most of it was done in the home. Market capitalism really only emerged when the technologies that Richard was talking about of extraction, the dynamos, the machines that allowed for the factory system to be born. That's really when market capitalism started. So sometimes we think of all this technology as the sort of child of capitalism, quite to the reverse. Capitalism is really a child of a techno-utopian view that the factory system could produce sort of a heaven on earth of commodities. Let's see here. Do we work this thing?
Green button?
This is why I oppose technology. I can't work it. There we go. See? There you go. So I'm going to be... Thank you,
Richard.
So I'm going to be channeling a bunch of folks today, which is... One is Carl Polanyi, one of my very, very favorite writers and thinkers on this. I recommend his book, The Great Transformation, to everyone. If you haven't read it, do. Another is E.F. Schumacher, one of my great heroes. And much of this is sort of patterned after E.F. Schumacher as well. But this is a great quote from Carl Polanyi. The more complicated industrial production became, the more numerous were the elements of industry, the supply of which had to be safeguarded. Three of these, of course, were of outstanding importance: labor, land, and money. Hence, they had to be organized for sale in the market. In other words, as commodities. And this is really, really, really critical, because a commodity is something that is manufactured for sale. So market capitalism is based on the fiction that labor, land, and money were actually commodities. Now, labor is just another word for us, humans. We were clearly not manufactured for sale. Land is just another name for nature, which is also not manufactured for sale. And money is manufactured, but it wasn't meant for sale. It was meant to be an exchange. Adam Smith, specifically in The Wealth of Nations, said, do not start commodifying money, because if you do, you're going to ruin the entire system. So the entire system is based on these fictitious commodities. Now, I'm a red diaper baby brought up here in New York City, and we assumed that the major problem with market capitalism was going to be with labor. So let's start with labor. So, labor. That means you and I are commodities. Sometimes I start this talk by saying, sort of, Alcoholics Anonymous, my name is Andrew Kimbrell, and I'm a commodity. Most of us have lived our lives as commodities, because that's what labor is all about. And in the early days of labor, when you were just not even considered a human being, as a commodity, you were disembedded from your humanity. We had child labor. We had the horrors of the seven-day work week. We all know that the satanic mills of England. Labor was just, it was a horror show, as we know, and had enormous impacts as well, I think, on our psychology. I have a degree in psychology as well as my law degree. Sometimes law does work, Anuradha, but I get your point on that. I am a lawyer, so I have to be a little careful there. But we, you know, it's amazing. If you look at the great psychologists of the 20th century, almost none of them talked about living your life as a commodity. What does that do to you? I mean, when I was an attorney, even before that, when I had small jobs, I'm trying to sell my life to an employer saying, hey, please employ me. What does that mean? But there was an exception. So Freud didn't talk about it. Jung didn't talk about it. But Eric Fromm did. I just want to read this to you just a bit. Eric Fromm says, the average person today is terribly alone and feels alone. He feels himself to be a commodity. By which I mean, he feels his value depends on his success, depends on his saleability, depends on approval by others. He feels that it does not depend on the intrinsic value of his personality, not on his powers, his capacity to love, not on his human qualities, except that he can sell them, except that he can be successful. That is what I mean by the marketing orientation. Others are experienced as commodities like oneself. They are not present themselves, but their sellable part. The difference between people is reduced to merely quantitative difference of being more or less successful, attractive, hence valuable. The process is not different from what happens to commodities on the market. But there was a problem, a major problem, which is that if you really did treat people as commodity, as labor, there was such disruption in your society, there was such revolt, it was so disembedded from the realities of what it meant to be a human being that it would destroy the entire society. And that's where you saw Marxism, and that's where you saw communism come in. So you had to buffer this fictitious commodity. You had to keep treating it as a commodity, but if you kept it as a straight commodity based on supply and demand, you're going to destroy the entire capitalist system. So what happened? We know what happened in 1917, right? Yeah, also, though, the Department of Labor was formed in the United States. And behind me, you see just the beginning of what all Mother Jones and all those labor people who fought and died by the thousands to be able to change labor laws and to protect labor itself, actually. Big green button. Okay, take a look at this. This is all the agencies in the Department of Labor. So you see how all those things for mine safety, you see the various things for unemployment insurance, you see all the various things that protected labor from being a commodity. We have the pension benefits, unemployment benefits, workers' compensation, OSHA, workplace safety. All of this government has been there to buffer this fictitious commodity, labor, from destroying the entire system. So ironically, when the people from the right say we're against big government and are big advocates of market capitalism, they're actually attacking the very thing that preserved their system. Big government was required to buffer labor because it's a fictitious commodity. It's disembedded from the reality of what it means to be a human being. By the way, the word job originally meant robbery, as in con job. And it was used by the English peasants when somebody was enclosed out of their land and gone into a factory, he was jobbed. And then if they went further, they would call them careering, which is the same word in England as careening, because they would see them around the streets of London careering around. So robbery and then careering around, sort of senselessly. And E.F. Schumacher, in his beautiful work, Good Work, contrasts that idea, that commodity idea of getting a job and selling your life, with the idea of vocation and profession, a calling, and spending your life in a profession. I think that's sort of the non-commodity view of that. And Eric Fromm, in a beautiful book called To Have or To Be, says that the deal, the Machiavellian deal here, the Mephistophelian deal here, is if you can convince people that their lives, as this is very much what Richard was talking about, are about having, not being, you can convince them to sell their entire lives away for money as labor, because they will be able to buy a house, they'll be able to buy a car, they'll be able to buy all those fun little electronic gadgets. So to have or to be really describes a lot of the deal that was made psychologically to get people to buy into this disembedded view of themselves as labor. But of course, it wasn't just labor. By the way, there were some Supreme Court decisions that said it shouldn't be a commodity, it has to be protected. By the way, when you look at all these things, it is important to remember these victories were fought again with the blood of so many people. This is all the stuff that was done to protect labor from being a commodity. But remember land. Land is just another word for nature. Land is also, as Anna Arendt was saying, it's used as a commodity, but it's not manufactured for sale. And if you continue to use nature as simply commodity, you despoil your air, you despoil your water, you despoil the very resources that are necessary. For example, tuna in the ocean do not understand supply and demand. They have never read Adam Smith, they have never read von Hayek, they have never read Milton Friedman. So they don't know that there's more demand, so they have to increase their supply. They don't know how to reproduce that way. Right? Topsoil, not very economic. It doesn't understand that it has to reproduce about how we want it to reproduce because we need it. No, it doesn't do that way. The Ogallala Reservoir takes 1,500 years to replenish itself. Doesn't understand supply and demand. And certainly the non-renewable resources that Rich were talking about, they have no idea about supply and demand because they're not going to be replenished at all. So we have an entire system that treats something as a commodity that is not a commodity, and tries to force it to obey supply and demand, and it just won't do it. So that's why we're going to be at peak water. That's why we're going to be running out of non-renewable resources. That's why we're running out of fish in the ocean. Because we're trying to apply in an autistic fashion the supply and demand commodity thing to nature. Now we've tried, here is look at all this government to try and stop that from happening, to try and buffer nature from being a false commodity. And by the way, as an attorney, I work in almost all of these pieces of legislation. Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act, NEPA, Water Quality Act, all the zoning laws. It's all a way to try and keep nature from just being an absolutely free market commodity. All this big government is there to protect us from doing that. We know it's not going to get there. You know, as a kid here, as I said, we thought labor was going to be the contradiction that would bring down the market capitalist system. As I became an environmentalist and learned more and more, I believed that it was actually be the destruction of nature that was no longer going to be able to support the system. And of course, I think that's still true. Here's all the natural resource agencies. All of these are put in there, again, to try and keep this commodity from actually being exploited fully. But I think I was wrong. I don't think that nature is going to be the final contradiction that brings down capitalism of those three fictitious commodities. So again, I just want to give you this picture. We have this, what Polanyi called this double movement. Wow, market capitalism was creating this amazing wealth of commodities, right? At the same time, it had to protect itself from the complete destruction that would have been created by these fictitious commodities had they been allowed to be treated as straight market commodities. And so over a long period of time, over the last century or more, we developed all of this big government to protect those three. So it's a double movement, getting all these commodity out and also building enough government, enough regulations to try and save the system from destruction. And one of the big, and Richard got into this a little bit, of course, one of the big things is money. Right? If we just allowed people to trade in money and to trade in debt completely, as we saw in the Great Depression and elsewhere, the entire system would have collapsed. Right? So we have all of these various acts to try and protect money. This is the Dodd-Frank. All of this government to say you can't just speculate at will. All of these rules have to be followed, otherwise it'll bring it down. So what's happened? So we see that by treating labor as a commodity, we had it disembedded from all basic human qualities. By treating land as a commodity, we had it disembedded from all natural laws of regeneration. Try to apply it to supply and demand. And now what we've seen with capital is sort of vampire capitalism. When I was a kid, 72% of the top 50 U.S. companies still owed their position to control and exploitation of natural resources. Very much what we were talking about today. By 2013, more than half of the 50 companies were involved in finance, computer-related, and financialization, and only 10% in natural resources. As of today, the top 25 hedge fund managers made four times more than all the Fortune 500 CEOs combined. Combined. Meanwhile, return on invested capital, which had stabilized around 5% 20, 30 years ago, is now 2% and dropping as investment corporations and managers extract ever more for themselves. So now even capital is disembedded from any production of value. Yes, capital is the enemy of nature, as Joel Cavell's wonderful book says. Yes, that ownership of the natural resources created the problems we just talked about with nature as a false commodity. But take a look at this. Capital is now no more about creating any value. It's about exchanging value. Richard talked about debt. These are the people that are betting on your debt. They're bundling your mortgages, your car loans, and they're betting on whether you're going to pay them or not. They're going to bet on what's happening in Mozambique and in Tanzania, or whether Greece is going to go off the euro, and then they double and triple and quadruple their bets. It's hedge funds and derivatives. In 1998, we had $5 trillion invested in derivatives. Today, it's close to $600 trillion. Right? That is 10 times the gross national product of the world is now invested in derivatives in the casino economy. Capital has become completely disembedded from exchange value and even utility value. Now it's created its own financial products. It's metastasized in order to try and gain ever more. That was a good sound effect, huh? Let's see if I can do that again. It's metastasized. No, it didn't work. I tried. 10 times the gross national product of the world in bets. This is a huge bubble. So I think what's going to happen is, well, let's talk to you like, let's see. These are not Marxists, mind you. This is Forbes magazine. Unless our bottom line there, unless our society as a whole reverses course, it is headed for a cataclysm. Because you can't sustain $700 trillion in bets. Because those bets are based on volatility, right? If you're a hedge fund manager, if you're working in derivatives, you want a volatile market. You want prices to go up and down. You want to bet short. You want to bet long. You want to be able to bet back and forth. So not only do you have $700 trillion in this stuff, it's made to be volatile. That is simply not sustainable. It's completely disembedded from any normal rules of capital. So I believe that we're probably going to have a 2008 times 4, times 5, times 10. I believe that Forbes magazine has about right, and I have other quotes there from Eduardo Porter and even Senator Elizabeth Warren saying we are headed for absolute catastrophe. So ironically, when I was a kid, I thought it was labor was going to be the great contradiction, which it still is, and then nature, which it will be. But I had not realized the irony that it was going to be capital that would kill itself. I didn't realize that capital itself was going to be the source of its own destruction. As poetically interesting, has a certain irony to it, but it's going to be very traumatic. We're talking about a lot of hard landings here, and we need to face it as this community looks forward and tries to create a new future, whether it be in the hard landing that Richard's talking about, that we're already seeing with the non-renewable resources, whether it's capital collapses. We know how traumatic 2008 was. Imagine that many times over. We know how many jobs. We know the people that lost their homes. We know the enormous human suffering that was involved. So this is going to be a hard landing. And with most of these kinds of hard landings, it's going to be very important what the narrative is. If you take the Weimar Republic example, as I call it, right, and the collapse of the economy in Germany in the 30s, they had a narrative, right? Who was at fault? Communists and Jews, right? If we were to have a collapse like this tomorrow, what do you think most people would say the fault was?
You.
Not me. That's not nice. No. Big government, right? These idiots don't know their own history, so they're attacking, and by the way, that makes this collapse even more likely because they're attacking the very safeguards that were put up for the last century to try and protect this vampire system from itself. So this system is a zombie paradigm walking. It is still extracting natural resources, as Richard talked about. It's still taking land, as Anuradha talked about. It's extracting now all this money, not any value, just moving it up to the top 1% of the hedge fund managers and to those who are moving the money around, right? It's a zombie paradigm walking, but no one knows this story. So when it collapses, we're going to have narratives. They're going to be blaming big government, going to be blaming immigrants, right? Unless we have a counter-narrative. Unless together we come to a counter-narrative. And I don't have a panacea for that. I don't have a panacea answer for you. But I do know that if we are able to somehow communicate that you cannot have an economy that treats people as mere labor here and around the world, you have an economy that's disembedded from the qualities of what it means to be a human being, from our power, from our love. You can't have an economy like that. You cannot have an economy that is disembedded from the laws of nature. Human economy has to be a wholly owned subsidiary of ecology or it will not work. End of story. Ecology is the true economy. And you can only have... We have to re-embed our economy in human values, re-embed our economy in nature's laws, and re-embed our economy into the proper use of money, whether you call it slow money or exchange. Money is useful as an exchange. When it's taken as a commodity, it creates the cataclysm. So it's our job not only to diagnose and speak that narrative, but to begin together to create a truly embedded economy that respects human values, ecological rules, and common sense aspects of money. Thank you.